This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln is one of the most famous murders in American history. The name John Wilkes Booth is etched in the history books as Lincoln's assassin. But what about the people who knew of Booth's plan, the ones who ultimately could have saved the president's life? Mary Surratt may have been one of those few. She ran a boarding house in Washington, D.C., where Booth often visited. She was eventually convicted of conspiring with Booth and is considered the first woman executed by the U.S. government. The new novel, Hanging Mary, sheds light on Mary Surratt's story. It blends fact with historical fiction as it explores how involved Mary was in the infamous assassination. My guest is Susan Higginbottom. She's the author of the book. She reads at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 19th, and Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 30th. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Thank you.
Well, I enjoyed your book. And tell us what we know about Mary Surratt.
Okay. Well, in the fall of 1864, Mary Surratt, she's a widow, she's heavily in debt, she decides to move to Washington, D.C. and open a boarding house there. And for the first couple months in 1864, things go okay. And then in early 1865, her son brings home a new acquaintance, John Wilkes Booth, a well-known actor. Soon, John Wilkes Booth is in and out of the boarding house. He's visiting back and forth. And at about the same time, some other strange people start to appear, staying just for a few days at a time, all sorts of odd people. And this starts to make a boarder, Lewis Weichman, a little suspicious. And it gets very suspicious one day in March when Booth and John Surratt, Mary's son, and a few other people come home. They're all waving guns. They rush into the boarding house. They're hysterical. They're upset. And Weichman doesn't know this right away, but later he discovers they've been planning to kidnap President Lincoln. But, you know, March goes on, and Weichman thinks, well, this is pretty much over and done with. And then, of course, Lincoln is shot. And the evening of the assassination, the police in Washington get a tip. They're told John Wilkes Booth spends a lot of time with Mary Surratt's house. And so they show up. They search for John Wilkes Booth. They search for John Surratt, who's also a suspect because, in case you don't remember, Secretary Seward was also attacked that night.
Stabbed.
Yeah. And so they believe that John Surratt was, mistakenly, they believe that he was Seward's assassin. So they look through the boarding house, but don't find either of these people, and the police walk away. But then 2 days later, on April 17th, they come back, and this time they have more information, and they arrest Mary Surratt and all the people in the house with her. In just a few weeks, Mary Surratt is brought to trial, and in July, she's executed.
Why do you believe Mary's story is one so rarely told? I mean, we just hear John Wilkes Booth. That's who we think did this all and was the mastermind, really, alone.
Yeah, I think it's, I guess, the way we're taught in history. I know when I was taught back in the Dark Ages, I think you hear that John Wilkes Booth was this crazy man who plotted to kill the president, and he was shot in Virginia, and that's pretty much all you hear. You hear about the big picture, but you don't really hear all the details, and a lot of people don't even know there was a trial of eight people afterwards, although at the time, of course, it was the trial of the century.
So to what extent did you develop Mary as an individual? Because we know the facts, historical mm-hmm. facts, but what did you do to try to create her, build her out as a character?
Okay. Well, I think I was interested in her role as a mother to some extent, because I think her devotion, she had two sons. The oldest, Isaac, was serving in the Confederate Army. And she had really not heard from him, I guess, throughout the entire war. And I think it was his absence that made her sort of cleave more strongly to her younger son, John, or Johnny, as he's called in the novel. And I think that was a big part of her experience. I think also Booth charmed her, too. And she had, before she came to Washington, she had been operating a tavern in Surrattsville, Maryland, which is now Clinton, Maryland. And it had become a safe house for Confederate spies, people passing, people running the blockade, passing up and down from, like, Richmond to Canada. And so I think she felt, to some extent, that she was pretty much helping the South already, and I think Booth probably persuaded her, well, you can just help the South a little bit more.
It's also, you know, this is a 42-year-old woman who is a widow, whose husband, from all accounts, was an alcoholic and a brute of a guy. Mm-hmm. And then here she is in living this fancy life, fancier than Surrattsville, you know, at the tavern in Washington. And for everything we know, is this John Wilkes Booth was a very handsome man, mm-hmm. charming man, who was kind to her whole family. Why wouldn't she be kind of taken by
him? Definitely. I mean, even after Lincoln was shot, it's very hard to find people saying, his friends still, hey, this is a great guy. I liked him. He wasn't, he was not the brooding loner, the sort of typical, stereotypical assassin. He was the exact opposite, really.
And it's interesting, at this time in Washington, you have Confederate sympathizers and people who were absolutely pro-Lincoln and for the Union living side by side, house by house. How rare was it to be a Confederate sympathizer at that time in Washington?
It was very common, actually. I think, of course, after the assassination, people tended to conform. They put up their black crepe like everyone else did because dreadful things were happening to people who were suspected of sympathizing with the assassins at the time. So everyone was going to be as patriotic as possible at that time. But of course, where Mary came from in southern Maryland, that was a hotbed of Confederate sympathy.
As one might imagine, if they were a mother, you do whatever you can to protect your sons and your children. And this might be Mary Surratt's downfall, that she was trying to do this. And the one that kind of drew her in was her son, John. Will you talk about who John was and his role in his mother's life?
Okay. Well, John was her youngest child. After his father died in 1862, for a short while, he served as a postmaster because post office was located in a little tavern. He was removed after a few months because of disloyalty, which wasn't entirely correct because he was disloyal. He had signed on as a courier for the Confederacy. He would go up and down from, they had, Secret Service had a branch in Montreal. So he would go down from Montreal down to Richmond and back and forth. He would run the blockade. And Mary wanted him to get a job because none of this is paying him, at least is what he said. And in early January 1865, he did get a job, much to Mary's delight. He gave it up after about 14 days. And the reason he gave it up is rather interesting, because he had asked Mary to, he claimed that he needed to escort Mary to do an errand. And this is just about the time he had met John Wilkes Booth. So it seems that probably his errand had to do something with John Wilkes Booth's plan, because he was, of course, at this time planning to kidnap Lincoln.
And when the boss says to John, no, I'm not giving you the time off, you just started, he says, hey, Mom, you go in and ask the boss if I can have these days off. I mean, she's just being drawn into this mm-hmm. thing, whether she likes it or not. So the book also features references to North Carolinians. Could you read a passage for us about that and maybe tell us what's going on in this scene?
Okay. This concerns Sarah Slater. She was a fellow courier. She was from North Carolina. She was from Connecticut, actually, but she had married a North Carolinian. And after he left, I think she was bored and needed a little money, so she decided to become a Confederate courier as well. And John Surratt, has brought her home to Mary and has told her she's going to be staying for a few nights, and Mary's not too thrilled about this. I think she looks like trouble. Where is her husband in all this? Serving in the army, the Confederate army. Assuming he hasn't been killed or captured, they're not a happy couple. I can't imagine why. Where is she from? Ma, I'm not proposing to marry her. Connecticut, actually, but her family moved to North Carolina, and that's where she met her husband. Having gone to school in Virginia, I sniffed at the mention of North Carolina, but at the same time felt a sense of relief. A Maryland boy like Johnny would never marry a little hussy from North Carolina, should Mrs. Slater lose her apparently inconvenient husband. She speaks perfect French and can pass for a native should she ever get caught, or at least a French-Canadian. And a veil? You'd wear one too, Ma, if you're carrying the secret she carries.
That's my guest, Susan Higginbottom, reading from her new novel, Hanging Mary. Susan reads at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh on Saturday, March 19th, and Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Wednesday, March 30th. Susan, tell us more about why you chose to include Mary's sentiments towards different states. You know, the ways in which she's pulled, kind of her allegiances are pulled both ways. And was that something that was common in the time, that you had people who were torn about what was right for the country?
I think so, yes. Even as far as the White House, you had Mary Lincoln, who had sisters and brothers who supported the Confederacy. It was a very difficult, thing for so many people.
Yeah, and that was just accepted. You know, okay, he's this way and I'm this way, and maybe we just won't talk about politics. Maybe that's the way it is still today. We just keep those types of subjects out of the dinner table.
I think so, yes.
So part of this book is half of the book is written from the perspective of Mary Surratt and kind of giving the play-by-play of what's going on and what she's hearing about the potential troubles that are going to go on with Lincoln. But then also the book, half of the book is from the perspective of a woman named Nora Fitzpatrick. Tell us about her and why you chose to include her perspective.
Okay. When I started in Oliver, I really didn't know much about Nora. But I wanted her to sort of an outsider, someone who didn't have very strong sympathies in either way, someone who could sort of look at what was going on in the boarding house from a sort of neutral perspective.
And how do we see Nora develop in comparison to Mary throughout the book?
Well, I think as what happens is Nora gradually becomes more suspicious. She's motherless. And she becomes very close to Mary throughout the novel because Mary sort of fulfills the role of her absent mother. And as she grows closer to Mary, and she also grows closer to Mary's daughter, Anna. But she also becomes more suspicious of what's going on because you have all these strange characters stopping the boarding house, staying for just a few nights at a time. And she starts to wonder. She also becomes more drawn to President Lincoln. I guess as the war ends, she becomes excited about that, caught up in all the excitement and drama. And so when Lincoln is shot, it's a blow to her. She's very emotionally distraught. And in a few days, she finds herself in prison for a crime that she was absolutely shocked at. She had nothing to do with. But just by association, she finds herself in prison not once but twice.
And from what I understand, actually had a rather sad end to her life.
She did. She married. And her husband was an alcoholic, a bit like Mary Surratt's husband. And the marriage went downhill. And then by the 1880s, she had become, I guess you'd probably call it now, chronically depressed. And she was put into St. Elizabeth's, the insane asylum in Washington, D.C., which, of course, still exists today. And that's where she died about. She was there about 10 years.
One of the things you do so well in this book is allow the reader to realize just how accessible people like the president were at that time. You know, when some big news was going on, you'd walk out of your house and you'd go down to the White House. You'd go down and there would be Lincoln on the steps. Will you read a passage from Nora's perspective and tell us a little bit more about this scene?
Okay. This scene takes place shortly after the fall of Appomattox. And it's the scene that episode that some believe that caused Booth to change his mind about kidnapping the president and leading him the path to assassinate the president. This is where Lincoln says he was considering giving blacks to vote, which, of course, was shocking to some people, including Booth. And Nora has come here to watch the speech with her father. When Mr. Lincoln finished his speech, to vigorous but somewhat restrained applause, I yawned and my father smiled down at me. "Let me take you home, Nora." I nodded to them, guiding me away. As we made our way out of the crowd in the Lafayette Square, I saw a familiar figure hurry by, talking intently, angrily even, with a taller, huskier man whose face was averted from me, but whose build looked somewhat familiar as well. "Why, that's Mr. Booth," I said to Father. "He must have been here for the speech as well." "Aren't you going to introduce me to your theatrical acquaintance, my child?" "Not tonight," I said, glancing back in Mr. Booth's direction. Somehow he doesn't look as if he wants company at the moment.
That's my guest, Susan Higginbottom, reading from her new novel, Hanging Mary. Susan reads at McIntyre's Books in Pittsboro on Saturday, March 19th, and Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Wednesday, March 30th. Susan, Mary Surratt is considered the first woman executed by the U.S. government. Will you tell us some more about the trial process?
Okay. Well, the trial was controversial from the very start because the government decided to use a military commission instead of a civilian jury to try the conspirators. And with the military commission, they only had to have a majority convict. So, of course, it made it easier to get a conviction. Then there's also, at this time, except in the state of Maine, criminal defendants were not allowed to testify in their own defense. So basically, you had to rely on impeaching your witness. And it was basically very weighted towards the government, which is not what we're used to today because you have all these protections in place for the defendant. But you're basically going there, the defendant was going to be blindsided. You know, there is like they call trial by ambush. You didn't know who was going to come to testify against you. You didn't know what was going to be said. And the lawyers for the defense there having to round up their witnesses at the very last minute, you know, sort of after hours. It was very one-sided. It was a very one-sided trial.
And what was the public opinion around Mary's conviction and execution?
Well, during the trial, she was vilified by the press. It was a very hostile press. But pretty much as soon as she was cold, basically, I think public opinion changed because no one had expected her to be hanged. The night before the execution, the soldier who was in charge of making the nooses had been tying them, and he decided, oh, I'm not going to tie Mary's all the way because she's probably not going to be hung anyway. And, of course, they were dead long. But I think just the spectacle of a woman being hanged just shocked so many people that people started to think of Mary more favorably. And indeed, I guess, until probably just about 10, 20 years ago, it was widely believed she was entirely innocent, that she was just a victim of a government setup. I don't hold that view myself, but certainly she became a more sympathetic figure as time went on.
And how did Mary's devotion to her son affect her trial? I mean, it seems to me as a number of times she could have thrown her hands up and said, you know what, I didn't know what was going on. I mean, what she was rather digging her own grave.
Yeah, and she was basically shielding, I think, her son, who had actually escaped to Canada, you know, after it became known that he was a suspect. But at one point, he claimed later he sent a message to her through her lawyers asking if she wanted him to give himself up. And she apparently said no. I mean, we have this as his version of events, of course. But if he had come back, probably she would not hung because he was always sort of the main target. And in fact, when he eventually was tried, he was able to get off just because sentiment had changed so much at this point. You know, it wasn't the same anger as it used to be.
And was there ever a point where Mary's name in the outside world, in the press, kind of changed a bit from someone who was really just operating as a devoted mother?
I think so, yeah. I think apparently, especially towards the end of the century, there are a couple of books, I guess, that sort of made Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, the main villain and all that. And also, Louis Weichmann had been the chief witness against he and tenant of hers had been the chief witnesses against her trial, and he became more vilified. He got this reputation as this man who had lied to save his own self from the gallows.
So finally, you know, what does Mary's story tell us about the way we remember history and its main players?
I think it just...
We only remember the main players, huh?
I think so, yeah. I think so, because it was such a sensation at the time, but I guess as the decades wore on, it just...
disappeared.
Yeah.
And there is a resurgence now a little bit, knowing about Mary Surratt, and certainly her claim as the first woman to be executed.
Yeah, I think the 150th anniversary of the assassination brought her name before the public a bit more. And also the film Conspirator, I guess, that was produced by Robert Redford, I guess probably about 5-7 years ago, that brought her name more to the surface too. And in fact, it sort of attracted me to her because it made me want to know more about her story.
Well, it's a really fascinating book. Thank you so much for speaking
with
me.
Thank you.
My guest is author Susan Higginbotham. She's the author of the new novel, Hanging Mary. It features the story of Mary Surratt and her involvement in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. Susan reads at McIntyre's Books in Pittsboro at 11 a.m. on Saturday, March 19th, and Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 30th. Just ahead, we'll hear the music of the pop duo Season and Snare. Please stay tuned.